Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 662, titled Further Reflections on Islamic Fascism and Media Control. This program is being recorded on February 1st of the year 2005. Let me begin by stressing again that listeners should take full advantage of the SpitfireList.com website. It's the best source for information about this subject material, and in particular the last two For the Record shows, 660 and 661, are dependent on those descriptions for a complete understanding. I haven't finished the description for 661 yet, but increasingly those of you who just listen to the on-air radio broadcasts are missing the better part of the For the Record experience, and indeed with some of the admittedly high-blown topics that I tackle, and given my preternatural inclination to being long-winded, I think it's really essential to use those descriptions. Now, by way of contrast, and again, in For the Record 660 and 661, I was presenting a complicated hypothesis in which the geopolitical strategy enunciated in the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk and the stratagem for gaining access control of the Muslim population, the petroleum industry, and the Earth Island, formulated by Otto von Bolschwing in the 1930s, those were joined with analysis of some of the media coverage of the recent Gaza war. And I can't stress strongly enough that people need to very, very seriously question the media in general, but in particular television. It's just rotten for you, and sadly that's where most people get their information. This is also not to say that the truth is automatically the opposite of what one hears. It's one of the reasons why fascist groups have sort of glommed onto conspiracy theory as a way of advancing their political agenda. Once someone realizes that the media, and indeed the educational system, the bulk of our culture, do lie, and lie profoundly about many things, it leaves a lot of people in a relativistic state of mind. They begin thinking, if Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill President Kennedy, maybe the Holocaust didn't happen, and they can be off to the races. That also is a dangerous mentality by which to be seduced. But something that people can sort of factor into their own individual experience, while we were being treated, if that's the word, to exorbitant and frankly pornographic coverage of the recent Gaza war, there also was another very brutal counterinsurgency campaign. In fact, as far as I can tell from the media coverage, note that serious qualification, this was considerably more brutal than what was taking place in the Middle East. A little bit more about the distortion of what we were seeing in the Gaza war, the recently hopefully concluded Gaza war. But while that was going on, the Sri Lankan army was conducting an apparently effective and pretty nasty counterinsurgency campaign against the Tamil guerrillas in Sri Lanka. Like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, this too is something of the heritage of the British Empire. The Tamil are primarily Hindu. The Sinhalese natives of Sri Lanka are largely Buddhist. However, the Tamil were brought in as plantation laborers and elevated to relatively significant status as sort of colonial elite, or elite belongs in quotes, for Sri Lanka. Then when the British pulled out, that left a legacy of bitterness on the part of the Sinhalese toward the Tamil. The Tamil were then brutally discriminated against, and off to the races we go. How many of you heard how much about this war? Again, by way of illustrating that the media playing field is anything but level. And not only that, but something else that'll sound familiar to people who are familiar with the coverage of the recently concluded Gaza war. From the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, January 29th of 2009, we have the following wire service story. It is Dateline Colombo, Sri Lanka, headline, Sri Lanka denies UN tale of shelled refuge. It reads in part, dozens of UN workers and their relatives spent a terrifying night huddling in hastily built bunkers as artillery fire pounded a civilian safe zone in Sri Lanka's war-racked north, according to an internal UN memo. The memo, obtained Wednesday by the Associated Press, said the artillery shells killed 9 civilians in a bunker and were apparently fired by government forces. The military denied the charge, and President Mahinda Rajapaksa renewed the government's pledge not to launch attacks on the refuge as it fought to crush the Tamil Tiger rebels and end the country's 25-year-old civil war. As concern mounted for the estimated 250,000 civilians in the war zone, Dr. Turajaya Fataraja, I'm mispronouncing that, the top health official in the area, said at least 1,140 civilians, 248 younger than 15, were wounded in the fighting and brought to three local hospitals. A number of things to note. First of all, the relative lack of coverage of the conflict in Sri Lanka. Compare how much you saw about that or heard about that with the daily and extravagant and frankly violence porn coverage of the recently concluded Gaza war. Also note that here we have a charge of the Sri Lankan government deliberately shelling a UN refuge in a Tamil-held territory. That also will sound familiar. Something as we should note in passing is that in areas where there's warfare, ongoing warfare, it has become something of a stratagem for one side to lure the other to fire on UN personnel and or installations. It's a great way of generating negative publicity for one's opponent. And as we evaluate the coverage of what has been taking place in the Middle East, one should not fail to note the huge amount of distortion. Again, the nightly news featured the obligatory scenes. Imagine a BBC voiceover. Another day, meanwhile, it was another day of violence in Gaza. And then it cuts to a shot of an Israeli tank firing. Then you see an explosion go up. You see a ruined house and some dead or wounded people expressing very real grief or anger. But what have you actually seen? You've seen a tank firing. You've seen an explosion. You've seen a ruined home or a few. And you've seen three or four people, and this is repeated over and over, and gives the impression, and an impression is what it is, that there's some sort of huge conflagration going on there. It's not to say, to be dismissive of what was taking place, it's war. And war is, as William Tecumseh Sherman said, hell, and not popularity seeking. But nonetheless, as we evaluate our media, it's worth noting that, remember the Serpent's Walk scenario, remember what Otto von Bolschwing has bequeathed us both in terms of his Middle East strategy and in terms of staffing the Republican Party with loyal underground Reich staffers. Bear in mind the fundamental distortion of what we're seeing coming out of the Middle East, and indeed an awful lot of the emblematic incidents of violence that has characterized recent coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Mohammed al-Dura case, which was a hoax. That kid was never shot, at least not by the Israelis. The Rachel Corrie situation, in which Rachel Corrie was kneeling down, not standing up, and kneeling down in front of a weapons tunnel. That footage was then doctored. We've seen the phony ambulance attack during the 2006 war against Hezbollah. And indeed, the Israeli advance in that war was halted by coverage of the alleged Qana massacre, in which a shell supposedly demolished a building, or a bomb or rocket supposedly demolished a building and killing a bunch of kids. But the bodies of the children are already in advanced rigor mortis. There was no blood, feces, or urine on them, as would be expected. And that was a phony incident almost certainly as well. Plus, embellished or deliberately provoked incidents in the recent Gaza conflict. Exactly how many people were killed and under what circumstances, I think, will always remain something of a mystery. However, I think we can say with certitude that what we were told about that conflict was, quote, not as advertised, unquote. And understand, too, that the media coverage of the Middle East is distorted because they are presenting what people want to hear. I don't dismiss the very real grief and anger of Palestinians who've lost people in that conflict or anyone else. But nonetheless, the by now obligatory, quote, Israeli atrocity, unquote, footage coming out of that part of the world is literally pornography for an awful lot of the amen chorus that receive it. It's pornography for the Arab street who have their anger distracted from their real causes of their suffering. It's pornography for the Arab leadership who are able to point the accusing finger at the Israelis and avoid any meaningful reform of their own societies. It, again, is pornography, literally violence porn, for an awful lot of the Arab and Muslim world. And that enables them to lose sight of the fact that despite the fact that the Arabs control the greatest source of wealth and power in the industrialized world, namely petroleum, the Arab and Muslim worlds, I should say, the fact of the matter is that going into the beginning of this decade, the 22 Arab countries combined had a collective GDP less than that of Spain. It helps to distract from the fact that Arabs read an average of 4 pages per year per person. And all of this makes for a very good way of diverting people's anger and attention from the real causes of their dislocation. And it's something that we're going to be resuming in the next program, For the Record 663, and that concerns the Muslim Brotherhood's successful penetration of Western society and the deliberate self-censorship by the media in an attempt at perhaps being a sincere attempt at being politically correct, or in the case of some of the higher-ups, kowtowing to some of the shareholders, such as Prince Al-Walid of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia. Christopher Hitchens had a very important column in the February 2009 issue of Vanity Fair. It's about media self-censorship vis-a-vis Islamic atrocities and or violence. And specifically, he talks about the media self-censorship in the wake of the Salman Rushdie fatwa, the fatwa put on Salman Rushdie by the late Ayatollah Khomeini, protege of Francois Janoux, associate of Ahmed Huber, and in 1989, Salman Rushdie was sentenced to death for publishing his novel, The Satanic Verses. And Hitchens' article reads as follows. At a dinner party that will forever be green in the memory of those who attended it, somebody was complaining not just about the epic badness of the novels of Robert Ludlum, but also about the badness of their titles. You know, the sort of pretentiousness, the Bourne supremacy, the Aquitaine progression, the Ludlum impersonation, and so forth. Then it happily occurred to another guest to wonder aloud what a Shakespeare play might be called if named in the Ludlum manner, at which point Salman Rushdie perked up and started to sniff the air like a retriever. Okay then, Salman, what would Hamlet's title be if submitted to the Ludlum treatment? The Elsinore Vacillation, he replied, and I must stress this, in no more time than I have given you. Think it was a fluke? Macbeth? The Dunsinane reforestation. To persist and to come up with the Rialto sanction and the kerchief implication was the work of not too many more moments. This is the way, when discussing Rushdie and his work, that I like to start. He is sublimely funny, and his humor is based on a relationship with language that is more like a musical than a literary one. I here to admit to my own worst plagiarism, invited to write the introduction to Vanity Fair's Black and White issue some years ago, I took advantage of Salman's presence in my house to ask him to riff on the two keywords for a bit. He free associated about everything from photogravure to the Taj Mahal without a prompt for 30 minutes, and my piece was essentially done. And this is a man whose first language was Urdu. Toward the end of the Second World War, George Orwell wrote to his friend Mulk Raj Anand to predict that one day there would be a whole category of English literature written by Indians. This, by the way, was before the division of the British colony of India into India and Pakistan. Continuing. Today, no literate person has not observed a novel by Vikram Seth or Arundhati Roy or R.K. Narayan or Roshan Mistry. And for most European and North American readers, the breakthrough moment came when Salman Rushdie published Midnight's Children in 1981. Here was someone born as a British colonial subject who had annexed the proudest part of the Raj's dominion, the English language itself, and made it his own. The novel is still the only one to have won the Booker Prize twice, and really that's the least of it. His latter novels have maintained the standard. I especially recommend The Moor's Last Sigh, which contains a marvelous portrait of the city of Bombay before the religious sectarians changed its name to Mumbai. Those who hated India, unquote, wrote Salman with awful prescience, those who sought to ruin it would need to ruin Bombay. That, by the way, is now known as Mumbai, for a little bit of historical background. His fictional genius to one side, Rushdie also chronicled the new age of migration and the contradictory synthesis of cultures. How often have I been able to speak and write about my friend in this way? Not that often. For example, when he was staying in my house back at Thanksgiving of 1993, so were about a dozen heavily armed members of the United States' finest anti-terrorist forces. And you all know at least some of the backstory. On Valentine's Day 1989, the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran gave Salman's book The Satanic Verses the single worst review any novelist has ever had, calling in frenzied tones for his death and also for the killing of all those involved in its publication, unquote. This was the first time that most people outside the Muslim world had heard the word fatwa or religious edict. So if you miss the humorous and ironic side of Mr. Rushdie, this could conceivably be the reason why. Just to restate the situation before I go any farther, 2 decades ago, the theocratic head of a foreign state offered a large sum of money in his own name in public to suborn the murder of a writer of fiction who was not himself an Iranian. In the event that some would-be assassin died in the attempt and failed to pick up the dough, an immediate passage to paradise was assured. Again, this was the first time that many in the West found out about this now notorious Quranic promise. I thought then, and I think now, that this was not just a warning of what was to come, it was the warning. The civil war in the Muslim world, not between those who believed in jihad and sharia and those who did not, was coming to our streets and cities. Within a short time, Hitoshi Igarashi, the Japanese translator of the Satanic Verses, was stabbed to death on the campus where he taught literature, and the Italian translator Ettore Capriola was knifed in his apartment in Milan. William Nygaard, the novel's Norwegian publisher, was shot 3 times in the back and left for dead outside his Oslo home. Several very serious bids, often backed by Iranian embassies, were made on the life of Salman himself. And all this because the senile Khomeini, who had publicly promised that he would never make a deal with Saddam Hussein because God was on the Iranian side, had had to swallow the poison, as he put it, of signing a treaty after all, and was urgently in need of a crowd-pleasing issue, unquote, that would restore his purest religious credentials. I nonetheless maintain that language and not politics was the critical question here. Salman Rushdie, raised a Muslim, concluded that the Quran was a book made by the hands of men and was thus a fit subject for literary criticism and fictional borrowing. Almost every historic battle for free expression, from Socrates to Galileo, has begun as a struggle over what is and what is not, quote, blasphemy, unquote. In contrast, the very definition of a fundamentalist, unquote, is someone who believes that holy writ, unquote, is instead the fixed and unalterable word of God. For our time and generation, the great conflict between the ironic mind and the literal mind, the experimental and the dogmatic, the tolerant and the fanatical, is the argument that was kindled by the Satanic Verses. Not everybody agreed with me about the nature of this confrontation. President George H.W. Bush asked for a comment, said that no American interest was involved. I doubt he would have said this if the chairman of Texaco had been hit by a fatwa, but even if Salman's wife of the time, who had to go with him into hiding, had not been an American, it could be argued that the United States has an interest in opposing state-sponsored terrorism against novelists. Various intellectualoids, from John Berger on the left to Norman Podoritz on the right, argued that Rushdie got what he deserved for insulting a great religion. Like the Ayatollah Khomeini, they had not put themselves to the trouble of reading the novel in which the only passage that can possibly be complained of occurs in the course of a nightmare suffered by a madman. Some of this was a hasty bribe paid to the crude enforcer of fear. If Susan Sontag had not been the president of Penn in 1989, there might have been many who joined Arthur Miller in his initial panicky refusal to sign a protest against the Ayatollah's invocation of Murder Incorporated. I'm Jewish, said the author of The Crucible, of that, and shamed many more pants-wetters whose names I still cannot reveal. Others remarked darkly that Rushdie, quote, knew what he was doing, as if that itself was something creepy or mercenary on its face. By the way, he certainly did know what he was doing. He had studied Islamic scripture at Cambridge University, and I well remember one evening at the apartment of Professor Edward Said near Columbia, when the advance manuscript of the Satanic Verses was delivered to Edward by the Andrew Wiley Agency. In a covering note, Salman asked America's best-known Palestinian for his learned advice, given the probability that the book might upset the faithful, unquote. So, yes, he knew, unquote, all right, but in a highly responsible way. In any case, it is not the job of writers and thinkers to appease the faithful. And the faithful, if in fact upset or offended, are quite able and entitled to explore all forms of protest, short of violence. Those last three words are not a proper sentence, but they summon to mind the various sentences, unquote, that have since been pronounced by the faithful in their periodic fits of rage. The Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, descendant of the Pater, shot down and then ritually butchered on an Amsterdam street after making a short film about the maltreatment of Muslim women in Holland. His colleague, Ion Hersey Ali, an elected member of the Dutch parliament, forced into hiding and ultimately into exile by incessant threats of death. Another small and unusually open and multicultural European democracy, that of Denmark, its embassies burned and its exports boycotted and its citizens threatened because of a few cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad published in a morning newspaper in Copenhagen. Daniel Pearl of the Wall Street Journal, taunted on video for being a Jew and then foully beheaded. By the way, beheaded in the name of Muhammad al-Dura, whose death was faked. It's one of the reasons why I talk about the Palestinian pornography, this extravagant and often embellished or even completely fabricated violence porn. Beginning again, Daniel Pearl of the Wall Street Journal taunted on video for being a Jew and then foully beheaded. Riots and burnings and killings all across the Muslim world, some of them clearly incited by the authorities in response to some ill-judged words about Islam from the Pope. These are among the things that have happened and have become depressingly taken for granted since the fatwa of the Ayatollah. We live now in a climate where every publisher and editor and politician has to weigh in advance the possibility of violent Muslim reprisal. In consequence, there are a number of things that have not happened. Let me give a recent and trivial example that isn't altogether lacking in symbolic importance. Last October, Sony PlayStation abruptly delayed the release of its biggest video game in 2008, Little Big Planet, because an accompanying track by the Malian singer Tumani Diabate included two expressions that, according to the Press Association report, quote, can be found in the Quran, unquote. Following the lead of the American press, which refused to show its readers the Danish cartoons and thus permit them to judge for themselves, the report did not care to say which expressions these were. It was a textbook incidence of self-censorship, or if you prefer, of crying before you were hurt. There was one American magazine, the Secular Free Inquiry, for which I write, that did print those Danish cartoons. Borders Books pulled that issue from the shelves. But that you can be hurt, let nobody doubt. A few weeks before Sony PlayStation capitulated in advance, so to speak, a firebomb was thrown into a private home in North London that is also the office of a small publisher named Gibson Square Books. The director, Martin Renge, was chosen for this atrocity because he had decided to publish a romantic novel called The Jewel of Medina by the American writer Sherry Jones, which told the tale of the Prophet Muhammad's youngest and favorite wife, the 9-year-old Aisha, age 6 at the time of her betrothal. The novel had originally been commissioned by Random House in New York. How did such a small London press acquire the honor of becoming its British publisher? Because Random House, by the way, owned by Bertelsmann, dumped the book on receiving a threat from a single reader that it might have another, quote, Rushdie affair, unquote, on its hands. The date of the subsequent firebombing, September 26 last, was the 20th anniversary of the publication of the Satanic Verses. So there is now a hidden partner in our cultural and academic and publishing and broadcasting world, a shadowy figure that is uninvited, drawn up a chair to the table. He never speaks. He doesn't have to, but he is very well understood. The late playwright Simon Gray was alluding to him when he said that Nicholas Heitner, the head of London's National Theatre, might put on a play mocking Christianity, but never one that questioned Islam. I brushed up against the unacknowledged censor myself when I went on CNN to defend the Danish cartoons and found that, though the network would show the relevant page of the newspaper, it had pixelated the cartoons themselves. And this in an age when the image is everything. The lady anchor did not blush to tell me that the network was obliterating its very stock-in-trade newsworthy pictures out of sheer fear. Sometimes this fear and this blackmail comes dressed up in the guise of good manners and multiculturalism. One must not wound the religious feelings of others, many of whom are poor immigrants in our own societies. To this, I would respond by pointing to a book published in 1994. It is entitled For Rushdie, Essays by Arab and Muslim Writers in Defense of Free Speech. Among its contributors is almost every writer worthy of the name in the Arab and Muslim world, ranking from the Syrian poet Adonis to the Syrian Kurdish author Salim Barakat, to the late national bard of the Palestinians Mahmoud Darwish, to the celebrated Turkish writers Murat Belge and Orhan Pamuk. Especially impressive and courageous was the list of 127 Iranian writers, artists, and intellectuals who, from the prison house that is the Islamic Republic, signed their names to a letter which said, quote, "We underline the intolerable character of the decree of death that the fatwa is, and we insist on the fact that aesthetic criteria are the only proper ones for judging works of art. To the extent that the systematic denial of the rights of man in Iran is tolerated, this can only further encourage the export outside the Islamic Republic of its terroristic methods which destroy freedom," unquote. In other words, the situation is the exact reverse of what the condescending multiculturalists say it is. To indulge the idea of religious censorship by the threat of violence is to insult and undermine precisely those in the Muslim world who are its intellectual cream and who want to testify for their own liberty and for ours. It is also to make the patronizing assumption that the leaders of mobs and the inciters of goons are the authentic representatives of Muslim opinion. What could be more offensive, unquote, than that? In the hot days immediately after the fatwa, with Salman himself on the run and the TV screens filled with images of burning books and writhing mustaches, I was stopped by a female Muslim interviewer and her camera crew and asked an ancient question, "Is nothing sacred?" unquote. I can't remember quite what I answered then, but I know what I would say now. Quote, "No, nothing is sacred, and even if there were to be something called sacred, we mere primates wouldn't be able to decide which book or which idol or which city was the truly holy one. Thus, the only thing that should be upheld at all costs and without qualification is the right of free expression, because if that goes, then so do all the other claims of right as well," unquote. I also think that human life has its sacrosanct aspect, and though I can think of many circumstances in which I would take a life, the crime of writing a work of fiction is not a justification, even in the case of Ludlam, that I could ever entertain. 2 decades on, Salman himself is thriving mightily and living again like a free man, but the culture that sustains him and that he helps sustain has twisted itself into a posture of prior restraint and self-censorship in which the grim, mad edict of a dead theocrat still exerts its chilling force. And, by the way, the next time the Khomeini's lovely children want to make themselves felt, they will be armed not just with fatwas, but with nuclear weapons. Indeed. And I would note in that context that Salman Rushdie was talking about Bombay. That is Mumbai. And in For the Record program number 369, I accessed a quote from the book Cairo to Damascus by John Roy Carlson that was published in 52 and is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. And in that, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a general in the Waffen SS, and the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, was in Pakistan in 1951, presiding over the World Muslim Congress, which he formed and which then, later, decades on, became the key vehicle for prosecuting the Afghan Mujahideen War against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. But in 1951, the Grand Mufti said, "We will meet next with sword in hand on the soil of either Kashmir or Palestine." Well, it was Lashkar-e-Taiba, a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate put together to help drive the Indians out of Kashmir, that perpetrated the Mumbai massacre. Mumbai is what we now call Bombay, that Salman Rushdie talked about. And some of the footage that came out of that, such as the footage of a little boy crying for his mommy, helped to galvanize the Israeli public in support of the most recent conflict in Palestine. Unquote. Things have changed a lot since 1951, haven't they? This concludes For the Record program number 662. Further thoughts on Islamic fascism and the censorship of the media. This program is being recorded on February 1st of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.